Welcome to the second podcast in the Sound of Solidarity series, brought to you by the Solidarity Organisation. We're a revolutionary socialist group in Australia. I am recording this programme today on unceded Wurundjeri land in Melbourne. My name is David Glanz, and my guest today is Ian Rintoul. Ian is a longtime refugee activist. He's a member of the Refugee Action Coalition in Sydney and a member of Solidarity. And we're going to be talking about the state of the campaign to free the refugees. So welcome, Ian.
Yeah, thanks very much, David.
There's been a lot of focus, for good reason, on the men who came here, primarily men who came here under the former Medevac legislation and were housed and detained for the most part in Melbourne and Brisbane. But of course, the tale of misery caused by the Australian government's detention system is much broader than that. Can you give people a bit of an overview about how many people are victims of Australian government policy?
Whoa, that's a very, very big question. I mean, we can start with, you know, the situation offshore. I mean, you've still got around 105 people in Nauru, 130 people in Papua New Guinea, for starters. And then you look at the situation in Australia, and you've got close to 1,500 people who are actually in detention centres in Australia, and that's not counting the people who are still in the APODs, so in the hotels, and that's, so you've got people in Darwin, Brisbane, Melbourne, who are still in the mostly the Medevac people. Some of them are the people who were brought from Nauru after the Medevac legislation was repealed. Some of them are in detention in Sydney, in Villawood. Others of them are in the APODs in, in Darwin. So it's a complicated situation, and that's the people who are in detention. So you've probably still got something like 1,800 people who are physically being held, 1,800, 1,900 people. But in the Australian community, you've got, probably a couple of thousand people who used to be on, Manus and Nauru in either the first or the second versions of the Pacific Solution. They're mostly in community detention in the community, and then you've got it's probably 30 odd thousand other refugees or asylum seekers who are making their protection claims, other people who are waiting for answers for protection claims, and on top of that, or included in that number, would be failed asylum seekers who now are mostly on expired visas with absolutely no support, no income support, no Medicare, nothing, just trying to make their way in the community. Most of them, well, they're unlawful, actually. In technical terms, they're unlawful, and they're unlawfully working.
So the government has effectively created a situation where people have to break the law in order to be able to survive at the most basic level.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's a level of, in which there is simply an underclass that the Australian government has quite deliberately created, and even that goes from people who are on protection visas who have not been able to access certain Centrelink support, a job seeker or job keeper when it was around, right through to probably a couple of thousand people, maybe it's even more than that, actually, but it'd be at least a couple of thousand who are having to work, live effectively, illegally, in the community. They rely on the support of a community of refugee supporters to for their accommodation.
For some people, the solution seems to be to find ways and means to get refugees to go to other countries. And in fact, some refugees want to go to other countries because Australia has treated them so badly, they have no reason to want to make a life here. But what are the options? There was the famous deal with the United States where Trump actually told Malcolm Turnbull he was worse than Trump was in his treatment of refugees. There is the offer from New Zealand. And now there's been some publicity about sponsorship for people to go to Canada. How realistic are these options, and should the refugee movement be advocating for them?
Yeah, look, that's a difficult question in a way. There's over 900 now people who have been accepted by, you know, the US. Now, that's well short of the 1,250. And sitting here at the moment, discussing at the moment, you'd have to say it's very unlikely that America is going to take, you know, 1,250 people, the people who were on, Manus and Nauru. There are some more to come, but you can count them in small numbers. You know, perhaps there's another 76. There's very small numbers for Nauru and Manus Island, some in Australia, including in Australia detention, who are, scheduled or have been accepted, to go to the US. The New Zealand deal is as it ever was. It's simply it's an offer. There's no indication at all that the Australian government is going to take up the New Zealand offer, and certainly no indication whatsoever that New Zealand is going to press that offer. They've refused, in spite of numerous approaches by everybody from Amnesty, through to the refugee groups, through to individuals, to ignore Australia and go directly to Nauru or to Papua New Guinea, and do what they did effectively for Boris Bichani, was to make arrangements so that people could issue visas so that people could travel directly to New Zealand. That's just not on the cards. Then there's quite a big campaign. People may be familiar with Game Over, which is being run by Craig Foster and Amnesty International in particular, to try and pressure Jacinda Ardern and the Australian government to accept New Zealand, to finally accept the 150 offer so that there can be people taken. If they were to be taken, it's also very unclear where they would be taken from. Some say that New Zealand would only take people from Nauru and Manus. Others indicate that New Zealand would much rather have its own selection arrangement of people who have been on Manus and Nauru and now in Australia. So that leaves the Canada, option. And I mean, the fact is that the Canada, option came up simply because there was no outcome. People who'd been held, 6 years, 7 years, Papua New Guinea and Nauru, the Australian government was, refusing, even if people are in Australia, they're refusing to provide any way that there can be, an enduring outcome here, or to be actually granted visas to, stay here and settle here and have family reunion and things that go along with that. So it was a very desperate kind of measure that people started looking at Canada, that has a very particular sponsorship program, which actually allows groups or individuals, groups of individuals, to make applications to sponsor people, and not always refugees, but to sponsor people who are in dire need through the Canadian system. There's been an extraordinary effort to actually get sponsorships in Canada, to, I think it's something like 144 people now. So there's a handful who've been resettled, and a whole range of others, up to 144, who are now formally, in the sponsorship program. I think for the Canadian solution has been a godsend for individuals, but for the refugee movement, I think we need to be very clear, that the Canadian solution, is only a solution for those individuals. And in many ways, it is simply an extension of what the government is always doing. Quite happy to send people, allow people to go to Canada, because they're maintaining, the fact that people can't come to Australia, won't come to Australia, won't be, resettled in Australia. And so while, I think the movement wishes people well in that respect, if they can get, to Canada and they can get sponsorship in Canada, but it is not, the solution any more than the American solution was, and something that we were always, kind of critical of. Understood why people would take the option because there was no other resettlement options, but I think the movement itself has to continue to fight for what it set out to do in the first place, to end the Pacific solution, to close Manus and Nauru, to have all those people who are on Manus Nauru in Australia, and all the people who are in detention, still medevac refugees and others, to be released and allowed to live in Australia on permanent visas with family reunion and all the the conditions and that go along with what is normally seen as part of the humanitarian program.
Yeah, and of course there's another group we haven't mentioned yet, which is, I believe, 10,000 or so refugees who are trapped in Indonesia. And that's as a direct result of the turn-back policy enforced by the Australian Navy on behalf of the government. So those people too are in limbo. Presumably the refugee movement would be calling and has been calling for those refugees to have access to Australia as well.
Yeah, look, it's an absolute dire, you know, situation. Very, very frustrating that there is so little that seems to be able to be done about it, because the government, not just the people that dumped there, but the Australian government's actually got a freeze, will not accept people for resettlement through the UNHCR from Indonesia, to Australia. So they've got the door slammed, both in terms of Fortress Australia and the turnbacks, and trying to prevent people getting from Indonesia to Australia. But even through the UNHCR resettlement arrangements, Australia won't take people from Indonesia. So at the moment, there is effectively the UNHCR has also thrown up its hands. There's effectively no resettlement happening out of Indonesia, internationally to Australia or anywhere else. So it's a very, it's a very desperate situation, and one that we certainly shouldn't, sort of drop the ball on.
We heard today that another Medevac refugee has been released from detention. I don't believe it's quite clear yet under what circumstances and on what kind of visa status. It's a reminder that after a little burst of hope around Christmas time, when dozens of Medevac refugees were released into the community onto bridging visas, with all those limitations, but at least they were released into the community, there are still dozens and dozens in detention, primarily in Melbourne, but elsewhere around the country. A question that comes up in the refugee movement quite a lot, and has done over the last 6 months, is when it comes to freeing the refugees, which has played more of a role? Is it the legal action by very dedicated lawyers, or is it the protest movement on the streets, or is it a bit of both, and how do we make sense of that situation?
Yes, it is a contentious question, the immediate circumstances of the Medevac refugees. And perhaps if I could answer the interaction between protests and legal activity at a more general level first, because if you look at the campaign over the last 20 odd years, there have been times in which legal action has been quite important, although I think it's also part of recognising the limitations that you can't point to very many instances where legal action has had any kind of dramatic effect in terms of altering the policy. But I think it's also important to recognise that the only reason there is such a significant body of legal interest in the refugee situation, whether that's Medevac or offshore or anything else, is because there has been a protest campaign. I think that's one of the achievements of the refugee movement over the last 20 years, which perhaps isn't recognised sufficiently. That in a way, and I think it's probably it's certainly recognised internationally as well, is that the campaign has managed to make refugees a central political issue in Australia for the last 20 odd years. And the things that we can see that have happened over the years, I think overwhelmingly because there has been a refugee movement that has fought the government, that has answered the government, that has attempted to mobilise people to continue to make it an issue in the community. And it really was only that kind of activity which drew the attention of the various refugee legal groups and the legal community more generally, to understand it was a humanitarian crisis. There was some fundamental questions of human rights which weren't being addressed. So and that continues to be the case. I think as soon as the refugee movement took its eye off the mobilising the community, organising the protests, then the general interest would also decline. So there's a lot of people now who are very dedicated and determined to try and follow those the legal cases through. But nonetheless, it's the movement and the protest movement which gives it that profile and makes it an issue as part of the wider political scene is concerned. With the question of the Medevac releases, the fact is that we've not had one release that has actually been a consequence of a court case. There's not been one court order for people to be released. The releases have come outcome in general, for the same reason that we've, you know, had the successes, you know, previously. It's been the protest movement. It's been the fact that it has been made an issue. I would like to say that we were in a position to put enough pressure, or had been in a position to put enough pressure on the government to actually force the releases. And while I don't think we can claim that, there's no question that the fact that there was a movement that continued to raise the issue of the medevac people, that organised the protests out of the hotels, it had the effect nonetheless of the government eventually actually releasing, well, in, you know, December and January, and then into February, you know, releasing 100 odd of, you know, the people who, you know, in the hotels, in particularly in Brisbane and you know, in Melbourne. It did seem the case, and certainly I was one of them who, you know, sort of thought that the legal cases that were actually being done in February had been the things which had pushed the government, because they were concerned about whether the court may find in favour of the refugees and against the government, and rather than have those legal findings, the government was releasing people. I think it's now fairly clear that's not the case, that we've got pretty much all the people who are now, you know, still in the hotels, the medevac guys still in the hotels, have got court cases, but we've still not seen, you know, one release that's been ordered by the court. Now, we're not sure about the person released from MITRE today. Maybe there has been a court order, but I'm not sure about that. We'll find out in the next, you know, 24 hours exactly why he was released today. But my suspicion is that it's the same situation that we had, you know, for the others, that there's been a government decision about his release rather than there being a, you know, a court order. I think if there had been a court order, I think we would have heard that in much more dramatic terms, rather than just, you know, he's the first guy since February, but I think he is has been released for the same kind of reason as the others. It's really the balls in the government's court. Yeah, they said on the one hand that in February that they had policy of actually slowly releasing, you know, the people who were the medevac guys who were, you know, continued to be held in detention. That's stalled. I think the court cases, and we can see that the government has thrown enormous resources into the court cases to uphold the legal position that they are entitled to hold the medevac people in detention, and they're going to hold that legal position. I think they're very reluctant now to release people because it would be seen, you know, as a way of you know, denting, you know, that, you know, that authority. I don't think they want anything to take away from, you know, the legal action that they're, or their defence of the legal action now is a way of showing people we do have that power, and we will exercise that power as ruthlessly as they have done in the past.
We talked about law and protest, but of course the other thing is government power and the possible alternatives to the coalition. The Greens have been very principled, but are clearly, in parliamentary terms, still very much on the margins on most occasions. Labour, around the medevac legislation, actually showed some willingness to take the fight to the government. And in fact, that was the first lower house defeat for the government in, what, some 60 or 70 years, when the medevac bill was passed with the support of the Labour Party. But then they seem to have retreated, and only a week or two ago we had the terrible situation where Labour voted through a piece of legislation which will make it legal for refugees without a valid visa status to be held indefinitely, potentially for the rest of their lives. A horrible piece of legislation. So how can we explain why Labour shows flashes of compassion but then fails to follow through on them when it comes to the big questions of principle?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good way of putting it, and it, because I think it is, it's flashes of exception to what has been, you know, the rule, and then that, you know, we've seen for the last, you know, almost 30 years since 1996 and the election of the Howard government, that the Labor Party has pretty much, and when it's come to legislation, you know, has been willing to vote with the coalition, except, you know, the legislative changes that have been introduced right through, you know, kind of that period. We've not seen them, you know, take any kind of principal stand for almost that entire period, over legislation. I think that's the only way we can understand their recent behaviour over the indefinite legislation. I mean, there's extraordinary explanations for why they voted for the indefinite detention legislation, but it is just it's special pleading. They say, oh well, the government was going to get the legislation through anyway, therefore we got a couple of amendments which sort of help a little bit. There's a 2-year it's not a sunset clause, it's a two-year review of the legislation. We wouldn't, that was the Labor Party introduced that. Now the powers of the minister to actually cancel a refugee visa is now reviewable in legal terms. That's also something that Labor claims it got, it got through. But it doesn't. It is just special pleading, and it's an excuse to try and cover up the fact that the legislation as a whole entrenches, the power of the government to actually indefinitely detain. And there's no way of getting around that. I think the other things that you've seen. I mean, there's two other things that stand out, I guess. I mean, three. One is the fact that it's still the case that the Labor Party, will overturn the temporary protection visas and the SHEV visas and establish permanent visas for, for refugees. And they will still do that if they're, if they're elected. That would be, an enormous improvement of the conditions for the people who are condemned to temporary protection visas, at the, at the moment. You've then got the Medivac legislation, but I think it's also important to recognise there the Medivac legislation wasn't the initiative of the Labor Party. The initiative did come from the independents. Labor did get behind the Medivac legislation, and that at the time was a very significant change, from its the general position that it had taken, over legislation. I think the other thing that we've seen is the way in which Christina Keneally in particular has been willing to campaign, for the Billa Wheeler family. But I think in all those instances, you can really see the Labor Party actually responding to particular elements of the, of the refugee movement. So, if you go back to the, to the early 2000s, it was really the, the refugee movement had campaigned to a point where every state, Labor conference had voted to adopt policy about overturning temporary protection visas and establishing, permanent visas. There was a huge, campaign waged by Labor for refugees, and the unions had adopted policy over permanent visas. And we saw the 2004, national, conference actually adopt that as, Labor conference adopt that, as policy. I think the Medivac legislation is another example where you can only explain because of the enormous support there was for the kids off Nauru, and then ultimately everybody off Nauru, kind of campaign, which saw perhaps the biggest constellation of refugee groups and civil society in Australia, sort of putting their names to, getting the kids off Nauru and to, closing Nauru. And the Medivac legislation really flowed out of that. And the Billa Wheeler family, I think, for similar kinds of reasons, it's an exception to the general position that the Labor Party has adopted, but it also, allows them to respond to the clear popular support, including in, in Billa Wheeler, that there is, for the Billa Wheeler family. So there can be, it can identify in one respect, can be, seen to take some kudos for, taking up the cause of the Billa Wheeler family. But, the overall picture is, there is of a piece with the fact of, of Labor's acceptance of all the arguments about, border protection and national security and the excuses for mandatory detention, for offshore detention, for the Pacific solution and the ongoing, incarceration of the Medivac guys. And we were not successful at all in trying to approaching the Labor Party for them to make a clear statement or to adopt as policy that they would, free, the Medivac, the Medivac refugees. So, that's what we've got. Unfortunately, Labor remains in general, I think, committed to the kind of policies, the border protection policies, of mandatory detention, as I've said, but we've seen the possibilities of where the movement has been able to force certain amounts of change at different points in the, in the campaign over the last 20 years.
That raises, in my mind, a broader question, and it's a question that's often raised amongst refugee activists. You look around and even at the most, we're talking about 30, 35,000 people. And when you look at the Medivac refugees, you're talking about, well, we're almost at the point where we're talking about dozens of people. Really, the numbers are low, and the political will of the coalition, and as you say, Labour adopting or accepting much of the same logic, the determination to exclude people, to punish people who have come here, and to spend phenomenal amounts of money in the process seems completely out of kilter with the numbers involved. I mean, everybody just rolled their eyes when Peter Dutton said that some of the refugees released around Christmas time were released because it was cheaper in the community. It cost the best part of $350,000 a year to keep one refugee in hotel detention, but that's been true for 8 years. So they've spent billions of dollars. There's obviously vast corruption. The report came out very recently about the huge overcharging by the private company running detention on Nauru. They are presiding over psychological damage, suicide attempts, self-harm, massive expenditure, and yet tiny numbers of people. How can we explain this?
Yeah, look, it is a good question. I think it's it's an issue that's been raised for the whole period of the refugee campaign. I think there's only a political answer to that. I think the government, consecutive governments, in one respect, but in particular the RNP government, has got so much political capital invested in the border protection policies that there is simply no way that they can now see to step back from that, that it is only the harsh border protection, well, not really the only, it's not only the harsh border protection, but the harsh border protection policies identify and characterize what the government has done, and so therefore is willing to throw kind of everything at it. I think the money question is also one of those big questions. I mean, so many people still think, oh, the money question, if only we could get across how much money is being spent, as if this was kind of the weak point. But I think it's always been a point that the movement is needed to make. If people accept the arguments about the asylum seekers the government makes, they're quite willing to accept that they will spend millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, in order to expel asylum seekers offshore, to maintain operations sovereign borders, of the expenditure of billions of dollars for detention in general onshore and offshore, that it's a political question. But for the government, that amount of money is a way of buying political, votes, ultimately. So it's part of maintaining, the general, border protection regime. It's the fact of, onshore and offshore detention kind of identifies the threat, in their terms, that, asylum seekers and refugees, actually represent. So there is an enormous amount of political capital, which is backed up by, the money that the government is prepared to throw at Nauru and Papua New Guinea to maintain offshore detention, and similarly the the contracts that you've got here with Serco and onshore detention. But it is one of the conundrums, because it does not seem to make sense, and it doesn't make sense in the normal terms of even sort of capitalist economics, I guess you put it that way. But I think you can only understand it when you see how much political capital that the government has got invested. And you can just need to go back and look at the Stop the Boats and the success of Stop the Boats as a slogan in the Liberals' minds, that for them it's that this is beyond anything else. We have to hold, we'll maintain the facade, we have to hold the line.
In the introduction, I mentioned that as well as having been a RAC activist for more than 20 years, that you're also a member of Solidarity, and that's the socialist organisation producing this podcast. Solidarity members are heavily involved in the movement and have been for a very long time, in particular on the East Coast, but elsewhere. What can the socialists bring to the movement that the many, many decent people with Greens or Labour or independent backgrounds can't bring?
Well, I think in some respects, even the the last discussion that we're having about the political motivations of the, you know, the government. I think one of the things that, you know, having socialist politics, you know, brings to the campaign is, you know, an explanation is to put it, you know, in some kind of context. You know, how can mandatory detentions, you know, still be the case? How can Labor Party be wedded, you know, to mandatory detention? Why is the government prepared to spend billions of dollars? You know, wouldn't they rather spend another couple of billion on a cruise missile, even from their, you know, from their point of view, rather than, you know, what seems to be a just propping up corrupt, you know, governments on Nauru and Papua New Guinea. So I think that's one. I think overall it's been, you know, having a political explanation that, of, you know, the motivations of the government and where the, you know, it's kind of, you know, the racism, the cruelty, the injustice that's associated with asylum seekers and refugees in Australia, you know, actually comes from. I think the other element, I think, is also the, you know, understanding of the kind of politics that were, you know, were necessary at different points in the, you know, in the campaign. I mean, there have been so many over the last 20 years of different, you know, twists and turns. In the campaign was also a recognition of having the politics to be able to respond to that. How do you respond to the turnbacks, argument that was being made, or the whole, you know, the time then the argument that we're getting from, you know, Robert Mann and other people would say, well, we accept turnbacks, and this is a way in which we can approach the government about winding back offshore detention, because it's turnbacks, you know, from their point of view that makes, you know, sense, their argument, to keep, you know, asylum seekers and refugee boats out of, you know, out of Australia. But we can use that to deal, you know, appeal to them to close, you know, the actual offshore detentions. It's not fulfilling a role, but I think that they're having the, you know, a wider, you know, political view and understanding of, you know, what motivated the government, you were able to, you know, to deal with those arguments that otherwise, I think, you know, could have, you know, derailed, you know, the, you know, the refugee movement. And it took considerable amount of, you know, discussion and argument at the time, in order to explain not why the principal position of the campaign had to be both end offshore detention and, oppose turnbacks. And they were of a piece, and the government saw of a piece, and it would have been a, you know, complete folly, you know, to think that we could drop one bit of it as in the hope that we can strengthen, you know, another side of it. I think there's a wider, again, one of the other issues which, you know, came up in a similar kind of way was actually the election of the, you know, the Labor governments and the role that, you know, Labor governments, you know, were going to play or likely to play in the whole, you know, scenario of the refugee campaign. So when, you know, the truth is that when, you know, Rudd was elected in 2007, other elements of the campaign, I mean, everything other than the refugee action coalitions and collectives, pretty much folded up with the expectation that with the election of Labor, we were going to see, you know, a government that was going to be, you know, true to its, you know, its policy, true to its conference positions, was, you know, was going to, you know, end offshore detention, going to end the, you know, the temporary protection visas and everything else. And, I mean, except for the role that socialists actually played, you know, at the time in maintaining the movement through that period, and arguing the importance of having, you know, the refugee movement, if Labor was going to be held, you know, to those, you know, to its actually policy positions. Again, I think it was one of the instances, if you look at the last 20 years of the movement, where the campaign could have very easily, you know, have disappeared, because it was an election of a, you know, of a Labor government. So I think overall it has been, you know, kind of a political understanding of both the immediate issues as they've cropped up at different points in the, you know, in the campaign, but of the wider, you know, the wider significance. I think of also recognising that for the government, the question of, you know, of detention and attitude to asylum seekers and refugees was never just, you know, it's never just a domestic issue. It was always connected to its foreign policy position, the position it took about the wars in the Middle East, of Iraq, you know, of Afghanistan, the attitude it took to, you know, to other, you know, to other countries like, you know, Sri Lanka, you know, why the government would maintain kind of connections with the, you know, Rajapaksa, the, you know, regime, you know, of Sri Lanka, you know, rather than, you know, or recognising why people were fleeing, you know, the Rajapaksa regime, but they were more interested in maintaining their allegiances with the Rajapaksa regime and returning, you know, people who were fleeing, you know, the Tamils in particular, fleeing from Sri Lanka.
And the other thing that socialists, I think, can bring to the discussion is what we call agency, an understanding of who it is who has the power to bring about change. You've already talked about the importance of protest. What about the role of the working class or the union movement?
Yeah, look, that's an important point you've brought up. I mean, the truth is that because socialists were involved in the campaign, if you look at the very first demonstrations that took place around, the national demonstrations that happened in 2000, actually, all those demonstrations, there were leading elements of the union movement were involved in those demonstrations in all, in all the capital cities. And that's also something else that I think that there was part of the analysis that, socialists could actually bring, to the campaign, that the prejudice and the attitudes that were being generated by the government were directed at the working class, and it kind of was I'm not sure what the word is to butcher the Rosa Luxemburg's slogan, but it was where the chains were forged, there they had to be broken, and a recognition that the ideological assault of Howard in 96, of Ruddock, part of that government, about the threat of that asylum seekers and refugees represented to the Australian community, they were arguments that were really directed at the at the working class, and it was also a recognition that the working class had a particular role to play, and the potential to play in encountering the policies that were being generated. And I think I may have alluded to earlier on in talking about shifting the policies between 2004 with National Labor, the National Labor Party policies. It was that was able to be done because we recognise the connection between the union movement and the Labor Party, and not as a way of simply going about the most crucial thing was actually changing the Labor Party's position, but the most crucial thing was actually changing the politics and the position of the union movement itself. And I think it's one of the things again which important to recognise when you look at the union movement. It has got very, very good policy on asylum seekers, detention, offshore detention, anti-deportation positions, which have come because of the kind of approach and the orientation that the movement has on the importance of actually doing work in the unions. Again, that's been a critical part, and it remains a critical part of the campaign. It's why you still look at the Palm Sunday rallies or the World Refugee rallies, and in most of the capital cities, you're going to see a representation of the Labor movement, on those platforms and in those in those rallies. It was an important way, I think, of also trying to draw in what is still represents the most organised movement in Australia, the people who are in unions, of actually committing them to a pro-refugee policy. And it was a way of, I think, of although at times they've not been as big in terms of the contingents in the rallies that we've had, nonetheless, that has underpinned the possibility of going to other sections of the community, of the opposition and the level of opposition there is in the wider Australian community. So the unions and that what they've represented in terms of the organised working class has actually been critical, I think, to be able to build on those foundations. And now if you look generally, if you talk about the it's the unions, the churches, the medical fraternity, there's probably not a part of Australian civil society at the moment which has not got policy, which is against the government, and that the position of the union movement has underpinned that for the last 20 odd years.
In fact, when you think about the victories that the movement's had, and there have been victories, very often it has been underpinned by the strength of the union movement and the general willingness to protest. So I think in closing, it's just worth remembering that although there has been enormous suffering, the movement, which and in the movement, I include the refugees themselves, of course, who have always fought back and organised, whether offshore or onshore. We have gained successes. We did get baby Asher out of hospital in Brisbane. The teachers were refugees, walked off the job in Melbourne and Brisbane, and helped underpin the campaign for kids off, all off. The Medivac legislation was passed against, in the teeth of opposition from the coalition government, and we have now seen many of our friends released from hotel detention over the last 6 months. But of course the fight goes on, so people should join their local Refugee Action Collective or coalition, or the Rural Australians for Refugees, and keep up the fight.
Yeah, that's right. We're not about to give up. Until we have got everybody out of detention, and more than that, I think the movement has to be committed to overturning the policy. We need an end to offshore detention, to mandatory detention, and the situation where people who come to Australia, who need to come to Australia for asylum, have a welcome refugee policy. And a movement in Australia which is committed, to be able to provide, the asylum and the protection, that people need. So yeah, if there's going to be more protests, we're not finished until we actually get the Medivac guys out, and then have a very close look at all the people who are still in long-term detention in Australian detention centres, and we deal with the underclass that the Australian government has created, a very vulnerable and exploitable underclass that they, again, I think they've quite deliberately created out of the policy that they've adopted for the last 20 odd years.
Okay, thanks for your time, Ian.
Okay, thanks, David.